So, over the years you were in Parliament, you must have witnessed some major events in our political history. For example, were you present at the joint sitting in 1974?
That was the most significant event, I think, in the whole of my time here, because, as we know, it is the only joint sitting as provided for in Section 57 of the Constitution. There have been other joint sittings for other reasons, but this is the only, strictly speaking, the only Section 57 joint sitting. I certainly must have been present. I don't have all that many clear recollections of it, but that's a time when I would have been a supervisor, and I would have been one of the supervisors at the joint sitting. And of course, it was a major event, and for all sorts of reasons. For the legislation that was passed at the joint sitting, for the fact that it was the first televised sitting of the Parliament, among other reasons.
How did it actually affect the way in which your work on the day?
In a couple of respects, it was different from a normal sitting of the Senate or the House. Of course, all the senators and members were in the one house. They did not speak from allocated seats. All the speakers came up to lecterns. There were two lecterns, one on the right of the speaker and one of the on the left of the speaker, right up near the speaker's chair in the House of Reps chamber. The proceedings were televised, and overall, the senators and members were exceedingly well behaved. There were very few interjections, and there were even fewer recorded in the Hansard record. Most of the speeches were prepared and read. So, in some ways, it was easier to report the proceedings. And of course, we were able to have a full staff with all the available reporters on the one chamber in the House of Reps on the one job. So, in some ways, it was easier than a normal House or Reps House or Senate sitting. And I think it was just a wonderful example of the way a parliament can work because, for instance, there were no rules existing before it was decided to have the joint sitting. The clerks of the houses and some of the leaders of the major parties had to get together and agree on a set of rules or standing orders for this unprecedented event, and they were able to do that. They were able to agree on who should be the clerk and who should be the chairman of the meeting. They were able to agree on the order of business. They were able to agree on the numbers of speakers and the allocation of times for the various pieces of legislation, which, of course, is the way the Parliament works for most of the time. If it weren't for the spirit of cooperation that exists for most of the time, the Parliament just would not work. And the joint sitting I see as a classic example of the way the Commonwealth Parliament or any other Parliament can work and for most of the time should work. I acknowledge that at other times there will be contentious debates and that's appropriate. But for much of the time there is a high degree of agreement between the sides and a very cooperative spirit.
You mentioned that you had a full team of Hansard staff available. Did that mean that you had more than one set of reporter and a supervisor in the chamber at any one time?
No, we wouldn't have had more than one reporter and one supervisor, but we may well have, for instance, had say 12 reporters. I don't recall that we used more than nine. We may well have used 12. We may well have used as many as were available, which could have been up to about 16 or 18. I just don't recall how we handled it.
You also had television cameras and therefore very bright lights in the chamber. Did that affect the way you had to work and your working conditions at all?
Not really. It was probably warmer than normal, but that might have been, the temperature might have been adjusted to allow for that. But that wasn't any real problem, no.
You also mentioned that the speakers used especially set up lecterns rather than speaking from the boxes.
That's right.
Why was that?
I don't know why they decided to do that. Perhaps it was because it was so that the relevant ministers and other front benchers could sit at the table. It was interesting that at a couple of points there was some discussion as to from which lectern certain members or senators should speak. It was obvious that speakers in favour of the legislation, generally speaking, would speak from the lectern on the right-hand side of the speaker. But when it came to any member of a smaller party, there was some question as to from which lectern that member or senator should speak. I'm trying to recall, I think it was Steel Hall, but that may be wrong. I think there was some question as to from which lectern Steel Hall should speak. But it worked very well. It did tend to make it more of a lecture type sitting than a certainly Senate debate style of sitting with more interjections. There were very, as I'm just repeating myself, but there were very few interjections and even fewer actually recorded in the in Hansard.
Were there any actual divisions on the day?
Yes, there were divisions on just about each piece of legislation. I have the official weekly Hansard here in my hand, and for instance, there is a division on the Commonwealth Electoral Act, which starts on page 43, and in that division, there were 96 ayes and 91 noes. 88. On the Senate Representation of Territories Act, there were divisions, and the numbers there were 97 ayes and 90 noes, and 96 ayes and 91 noes.
Mm. There must have been an immense exercise of trying to get people to move from one side of the chamber to the other, given the number of people who were in there. How did they manage to move smoothly without disruption when the space is so small and there were nearly 190 people in there?
I don't think there was much need to move from side to side because, generally speaking, the members of the government party who were supporting the legislation sat on the right, and members of the opposition, senators and members, all sat on the left of the speaker.
So there was little crossing of the floor?
Well, in terms of the expression that's often used, crossing the floor, which actually means that somebody who would normally be expected to vote one way decides to vote the opposite way, there was none of that.
So from your perspective and from Hansard's perspective, the whole operation went very smoothly?
Exceedingly smoothly. It was an excellent example of how a parliament can work.
What about other major events which took place during your time in Parliament?
I guess the first one was the retirement of Sir Robert Menzies, but that didn't occur in the Parliament, but was a major event. Again, the 1967 referendum was a major event, but of course the legislation to propose the referendums went through the Parliament, but the referendum was something outside the Parliament. That was very significant. Harold Holt's disappearance, again, outside the Parliament, but a very significant turning point in Australia's political history. Sir John Gorton's resignation as leader of the Liberals and Prime Minister in March 1971. Okay, it occurred here in Parliament House, but it wasn't within the chambers. But that was another significant event. The next one I've got on a little list that I drew up was the double dissolution in 1974 and the subsequent joint sitting, followed later by the dismissal of the Whitlam government in November 1975.
Were you in the chamber for that? When the events unfolded after that, after the Governor-General had acted?
It's another instance where there have been so many references and so much written about those events that each time you read those things, you become more and more certain that you were actually there. And my recollection is that I was actually in the Senate chamber after lunch. Again, I have gone back to Hansard from time to time to try to reinforce my recollection. But the funny thing is that there is very little that finished up in the Hansard record about the events in the Senate that afternoon. But my clear recollection, my recollection supported by frequent references back to the Hansard of that afternoon, is that I was there when the Senate resumed after lunch, and the Senate had some business to finish off from before lunch. They had not finished the tail end of question time, so they proceeded to deal with that unfinished business from before lunch, remembering that the both houses had started late that morning because it was Remembrance Day. And then when that business had been completed, some words such as Ken Reet saying to Senator Withers, "What do we do next?" And Withers responding with, "Bring on your bills." And Reet being most surprised, but recognising that those bills, the resumption of the debate on those appropriation bills, was sitting at the top of the notice paper. If they weren't going to be brought on, somebody on the government side had to move a motion to rearrange the order of business. So there was, because those bills were sitting at the top of the notice paper, and neither Ken Reet nor Doug McClelland took any action to rearrange the order, the clerk just then called on those bills and they were put through the Senate without any discussion at all. And to the surprise of everybody, the appropriation bills had gone through. And suddenly the word got around that at that point in the Senate chamber, not to the surprise of Senator Withers, but to the surprise of Ken Reet and Doug McClelland and everybody else in the Senate, on that side of the Senate, that the Whitlam government had been dismissed.
How did you find out? If you were actually on doing a turn, how did you find out?
Again, I don't have a clear recollection, but with my recollection of actually being in the chamber at that time, I think I probably heard Withers or somebody like that telling the Labor ministers, "Don't you know that the government's been sacked?" or some words to that effect.
Were these words recorded?
No.
So these were simply conversation in the background, which was not...
Yeah. And those words that I seem to remember, such as Ken Reet saying, "What do we do next?" That's not something that would ever get anywhere near being recorded in Hansard. And because of the way the formal parts of the proceedings were recorded in Hansard, the actual words that were used to put the legislation through didn't ever get into Hansard. Words such as the clerk standing up and saying, "Order of the day number one, appropriation bill so-and-so, so-and-so, resumption of debate on the motion by Senator Reet that the bills be read a second time," or something like that. None of that appears in Hansard. That's just the way of bringing on the next item of business. And in Hansard, that just appears with the title of the bill as a subheading, full caps, bold subject heading. And the motion is then actually appears underneath it. Debate resumed on motion by Senator Reet that the bill's been now read a second time, or whatever the appropriate motion was. And then the next line would be question resolved in the affirmative. Bills read a second time and pass through their remaining stages without amendment or debate. Some words like that, a narrative line which describes the result of the proceedings without going word for word through the procedure.
When you were relieved from your term and got back to your office, was there any talk about this? Or?
Yes, well, of course. Everybody was talking. Everybody was racing outside because crowds were already gathering outside the front of the building. The word had got around Canberra, and everybody had started to gather. By this time, it's nearly 2:30. Crowds were gathering, and most of us went out the front of the building.
You did as well?
Yes.
Where did you? Yeah. So what happened then?
Well, there's still another meantime, the House was still sitting. The Senate had adjourned, but the House of Reps was still sitting. So people who were working on the Reps were still working away. It wasn't until, I've forgotten now, but somewhere about 3:00 that the sitting of the House was suspended. And then everybody was out the front when Sir David Smith arrived to read the proclamation dissolving the Parliament. And then Gough Whitlam came, or was there when that proclamation was read, and then he took the microphone and made his famous comments.
Where were you actually in relation to that?
Somewhere down in the front there. I'm sure I was out the front there and heard that proclamation and heard Whitlam, but probably somewhere on the Senate, towards the Senate side of the front of the building.
What was your personal reaction to that? How did you feel about
astonishment. Astonishment. Could not understand what had happened, and I guess my personal reaction was this is an unelected Governor General sacking the elected Prime Minister. Admittedly, he didn't have a majority in the Senate, but there had been all those unusual circumstances which led or meant that the government still did not have a majority in the Senate, disbelief, astonishment that such thing could have happened.
So would you have considered yourself to be a Labor supporter or sympathiser at the time?
Well, always tried to be impartial in everything that I did. I suppose because of my family background, largely, I tended to, my politics, such as they were, would have been a little bit left of centre. My family background was, my father had been a member of the Labor Party, but I had never been. But he had not been heavily involved at all. But he'd been a working man all his life and had been a Labor supporter and a member of the Labor Party at one stage. So from a family background, I tended to be a little bit left of centre.
What happened to the Hansard reporters after the hearing, Whitlam on the front steps? What did you do after that?
Well, we would have just cleaned up everything for that sitting day, and and the Daily Hansard for the previous day cleared the decks, as it were, and then gone home. Because the dissolution of the Parliament dissolved not only the both houses, but all the committees. So apart from preparing the indexes for for that sessional period and clearing any committee transcripts that hadn't been completed, we wouldn't have had any work to do after from a short time after the 11th of November.
Any other events of
The next major event I've got in a little list of here is the change of government when Bob Hawke came in 83, and then the move up to the new Parliament House. They were the most significant events.
The change of government in 1983, when the lead up to that, before the Malcolm Fraser was in, was in his last days as Prime Minister, and before he dissolved Parliament.
Well, of course, the unusual thing is that my understanding from reading the books and so on is that Malcolm Fraser decided that he would call an election for March, it would have been, 83, thinking that Bill Hayden would be his opponent at that next election. And it was on that very same day that the election was called that the Labor Party, in effect, decided to change leaders. And so Malcolm Fraser went into the election thinking that he was going to be opposed by Bill Hayden, and in fact he was opposed by Bob Hawke.
Was Parliament sitting at the time?
No, because it happened right at the end of January. And that's my recollection, that it was late January or early February. And then the election was in March 83, wasn't it? Yeah.
Did you have, during, you were obviously in all many years in the House, but did you have much contact with parliamentarians?
Our contact, my contact with members and senators was much closer in committees than in the houses. Of course, we didn't ever speak to members and senators in either of the houses, except if I was the senior officer in the second Hansard chair in either the chamber. Occasionally, a member or senator would come and just have a word about something, ask a question, or sometimes hand over his or her copy of his typescript, either the greens or the pinks, instead of calling an attendant down to take them. Some members made a practice of handing them over at the table. But apart from that, we didn't ever speak to, or very rarely did we speak to members and senators. Occasionally, there might be a little, a very short conversation with somebody at the leader of the opposition or somebody sitting in the chairs next to us, but nothing significant. And not very often did that happen.
You mentioned that when you were with committee, doing committee work, there was more contact.
Much more, because we were travelling with the members many on many occasions. And we were spending, sometimes we were staying in the same hotels and spending quite a bit of time with them. So we did have much more contact with them when we were working on committees.
Were there any that you had developed some kind of a friendship or a bit more of a relationship with?
No, I didn't really develop relationships with any members or senators in the houses or on committees. The only very small relationships happened to be with Ian Sinclair, because at one point Ian Sinclair and his family lived in Deakin, and they attended the church to which our family went in Curtin. And the children came to the Sunday school there. So occasionally we would see the Sinclairs at church, and then of course we'd see Ian Sinclair in the. I would see Ian Sinclair in the chamber. So we had a very small relationship there, and coincidentally, the other one was also a Country Party member, and that was Ralph Hunt. Ralph Hunt was the member for Gwydir, and he had a home in the town of Moree, right next door to my sister and brother-in-law and their family. So that established a connection there. And then Ralph Hunt's son was in the same class at Canberra Grammar as our youngest son, and they played cricket together. So occasionally we would see the Hunts at school functions, fetes and parent-teacher nights and things like that, and also at cricket matches. So we did get to know the Hunts and Ralph Hunt in particular reasonably well. I can't recall any other members. Even the fact that the Senator Bertie Milliner, who was one of the senators about whom there was a lot of discussion in relation to the dismissal, because Senator Milliner died and was not replaced by a Labor senator. And my father's family and the Milliner family had grown up together in Brisbane. But we had, and I had gone to school with one of Fred Milliner's nephews. But that was never any relationship. I never had any real social contact or anything like that with Senator Milliner, but that, I suppose that's the only other social relationship with any member.
So you've worked around and with many of the parliamentarians over long periods of time, over many, many, many years, and yet was there some kind of distinction between Hansard reporters and the parliamentarians, so that they, in a sense, didn't naturally become get close? Or?
Oh yes, very, very definitely. We were working for all the members and senators. And that was just a professional relationship. There was very little social relationship apart from when we were away on committees, perhaps travelling with the committee, staying in the same hotels occasionally. And I think I referred last time to the end of session parties, where some members would come along to the Hansard end of session party, and that went way back. I can remember here in the in our offices here on the House of Reps side that there were some end of session parties where members would come along, perhaps because our end of session party started later than a lot of the others and therefore was still going after some of the others had finished. So the members were looking around for somewhere to continue, to keep going. And our Hansard party was a convenient one to come to. So, and then when we moved up onto the Senate side of the building, Senator Walsh's ministerial office was right next to ours. In fact, it was straight opposite the offices where we had our technical offices. And we also had a small library in that area, directly opposite Senator Walsh's offices. And he was a great party goer and would often come to the Hansard end of session parties with some of his colleagues.
When you travelled with the committees, you mentioned you might be staying at the same hotel. Was there any socialisation between, say, the Hansard staff and the committee members themselves?
We'd have, if we were on a committee where we were travelling as a group, for instance, I mentioned that there were a couple of committees where I was a reporter and the committee had arranged for a defence or VIP aircraft to be used. We would travel as a group on that aircraft, stay in the same hotels, and we'd eat together and generally spend virtually the whole time together. But on the other hand, if we were working on a committee in one of the capital cities, for instance, we would be staying at any hotel that we could book into that would be within our travelling allowance, and it would be fairly unusual for any committee members to be staying in those hotels. It might be even in capital city in which some of the members lived, so they wouldn't be staying in hotels, but even the members from places other than that capital city would almost invariably be staying in different hotels from us. Mm. So, and apart from the meeting itself, we wouldn't have much contact with them.
So you still must, through those, even that level of contact, must have got to know something more about many of the members of parliament, simply by seeing them in action and at, I'd say, closer than you would be maybe in the chambers. Were there any that you particularly admired or respected, came to respect as individuals?
Yes. One that sticks in my mind is Kim Beazley Sr. He had been in the Parliament, of course, for many years before I came in 1960. And I mentioned at one of these earlier sessions of these interviews that I had two extended trips on the House of Reps committee that was investigating Aboriginal voting rights. And Kim Beazley Sr. was a member of that committee. I spent a little bit of time quite early in my career on that committee going around with him, and I couldn't but admire his the man. He was just a wonderful human being. His knowledge and interest in Aboriginal affairs was to be admired. Again, he was a wonderful speaker. He was one of the best speakers. Small s I'm talking about, of course, one of the best small s speakers in the Parliament in my time. Not only in terms of delivery of the speech, but his knowledge of the subject. Of course, sometimes he was referred to as the student prince of the Labor Party, particularly in his early years. And he was a front bencher for much of the time, a minister for education throughout the whole of the Whitlam government, if I'm not mistaken. So I had a lot of admiration for Kim Beazley Senior in particular, and although I didn't have a lot to do with Kim Beazley Junior, I have a high regard for him at all. I think he has followed in his father's footsteps in many respects, and I think he would have made an excellent Prime Minister, and but it wasn't to be. Kim Beazley was one. There were a couple of others that I admired for their work ethic. Senator Reg Wright is one who comes to mind. He was a very frequent speaker in the Senate. He wasn't always the easiest speaker to report because he had a very he was apt to get into circumlocution, and although he was a distinguished lawyer, he didn't always express himself succinctly. But his attention to detail and the way in which he applied himself to the job of a senator was exemplary, in my opinion. And of course, he was a senator who, on occasions, was willing to stand up for what he thought was right, even if it wasn't party policy. He was not unknown to cross the floor and vote against his party on many occasions. Of course, although he was a senator for many, many years, he didn't become a minister until quite late in his career. So he was somebody to be admired. This is not easy to pick out examples, remembering that over a period of 30 years there would have been hundreds of senators and members. Billy Snedden as Speaker was certainly somebody to be admired. In my experience, I would think that Billy Snedden was the best speaker that the House had. He was, whereas many presiding officers were not inclined to explain decisions that they made. For instance, a senator might take a point of order, and most of the presiding officers would merely say, "There's no point of order," and that was the end of it. but often Billy Snedden would explain why he decided that there was no point of order, or why he made a decision. Plus the fact that he, especially in his time as Speaker of the House, was a real Parliament man. He on occasions did propose that Australia follow the British example of having a truly independent Speaker. And I think, in a similar vein, he deserves quite a bit of the credit for the legislation that resulted in special or separate appropriation bills for the Parliament. Whereas previously the money to run the Parliament had just been included in the general appropriation bills. In recent years there have been separate appropriation bills for the money to provide for the running of the Parliament, and Billy Snedden had a lot to do with that, which I think was a good initiative.
When exactly was Snedden speaking?
When the Fraser government came in 75. My recollection is that Billy Snedden was the speaker there for, I hope I'm not wrong about this, but for most of the term of the Fraser government, or the earlier part. Yeah, that sounds right. So as speaker, he was certainly admirable, in my opinion.
You've already mentioned that you obviously had great admiration and respect for Sir Robert Menzies.
Yes, although in my time he was he was in the twilight years of his career. Another senator is Sir John Carrick. He was another real gentleman, Sir John Carrick. He was liberal through and through, conservative in many ways, but sometimes I've been asked to try to say what was the best speech I ever heard in Parliament, and that has always been difficult, but when I've really been pushed, I've usually come down to the point of saying that a speech made by Sir John Carrick very soon after he came into the Senate, and it might have even been his maiden speech in the Senate, I'm not absolutely certain of that, but it was a speech on a death penalty abolition bill. And in the light of Sir John Carrick's background, remembering that he'd spent most of the Second World War in Changi, after the Second World War he'd been the state director of the New South Wales Liberal Party in the New South Wales division of the Liberal Party for many years, had been a mentor for many successful Liberal politicians, and he made a speech on the death penalty abolition bill setting out in great detail and with great clarity his reasons for supporting that bill and for the abolition of the death penalty. And And I thought that was pretty amazing. Of course, there've been some characters as well. I don't put them in the same category as some of those other people that I've tried to talk about. But one character was Leslie Halen, who was a left winger in the Labor Party, a journalist, and a very difficult member to report, because he used to speak very quickly and he used lots of literary allusions and quite elegant language. All in all, he was regarded as one of the more difficult speakers to report. And one of the things for which he is most remembered, and again, I don't think I was actually in the chamber when this happened, was that one night, I think it was in 1963, straight after dinner, Billy Wentworth was speaking, and Wentworth sat in the on the end of the back row on the government side. And he was accusing the Labor Party of being, to use his phrase, infected with communism. And he was hammering this point on and on. And he had been speaking, my recollection is, he's been speaking before dinner, and he resumed his speech after dinner. And shortly after that, a person came through the door and stood next to Wentworth, and he had a white coat and a stethoscope round his neck. And he said words to the effect, "Sir, the car is waiting for you." And the house just dissolved into absolute bedlam. And of course it was Halen. He had borrowed a coat from one of the waiters in the dining room, and had found a stethoscope from one of the doctors in the house, and had come in to take the mickey out of Billy Wentworth. And that that's one of the best practical jokes that everybody remembers in the house. So they were a couple of characters. Wentworth, of course, was a real character, an eccentric, somebody with very progressive and really ahead of his time in many, many respects. He was a great advocate for the standardisation of the rail gauges from way back. He was an environmentalist. He was very interested and did a lot of wonderful work on Aboriginal affairs before it became a real national issue. On the other hand, he was an ardent anti-communist and very strongly right-wing in that respect, and took every opportunity he possibly could find to attack the Labor Party for his belief that the to use this phrase, that the Labor Party was infected with communism. And of course, he was another, like Reg Wright, who was in the Parliament for many, many years before he became a minister. So those are a couple of characters that I just had a little note about. Jim Killen was another character who made some quite excellent speeches. He trained as a lawyer after he came into the Parliament, and practiced as a lawyer. He was a very entertaining speaker. Some people might say that often there wasn't a great lot of substance in his speeches, but he again was another person who was in the Parliament for quite a long time before he became a minister, and he had a very good personal relationship with Gough Whitlam. They often exchanged notes in the chamber, and it's said that many of the notes were written in Latin. And Killen was an inveterate practical joker, and got himself into bother with his colleagues on many occasions for his practical jokes. I suppose the sorts of things that he used to do was he would talk to Freddie Daly, and they would have a bit of a chat about something. And this story's been written up in the books as well. On one occasion, there was a ministerial vacancy, and Daly and Killen were talking about who might get this vacancy, and Killen evidently suggested three or four names. And Daly said to him, "Well, why don't you get a message to them to call around and be ready at Malcolm Fraser's office when he comes back from dinner?" And so, lo and behold, three or four members turned up sitting outside the door. And when Malcolm Fraser came back from dinner, he said, "What are you fellas doing here?" And they said, "Oh, we've been told that you want to see us, perhaps about the vacancy." And he said, "Get Killen." So Killen and Daly duly went round to see Malcolm Fraser, and Freddie Daly saw that there was a camera sitting on a table, and Freddie Daly said, "What's that?" And Malcolm Fraser said, "Oh, that's my camera." And he said, "Well, why don't you take a photo of us?" And he did. That's written up in the books. I think it's written up by Killen in one of his books. And the other story about Killen, while I'm thinking of it, and we'll have to break off, is that the story goes that Eddie Ward, who was another wonderful character called the Firebrand of East Sydney, made wonderful speeches. Everybody thought he was difficult to report, but he wasn't. He was quite easy to report. But Eddie Ward was sitting one day during proceedings were on a condolence motion, and Eddie Ward's alleged to have said to Corwin, "All I want to say when I go is, all I want people to say is, he was loved by all." And the next part of the story is that when Eddie Ward died, Menzies made a really appropriate and very generous condolence speech about Eddie Ward, despite the fact that they'd been bitter political enemies for donkey's years. And after this speech, when Menzies went outside the chamber, Killen happened to run into him, and he said to Menzies, "Bob, how can you get up there and make a speech like that about Eddie Ward after all the years of bitterness and so on that has been gone on?" And Menzies looked at Killen and he said words to the effect of, "My boy, I think we might stop because I've forgotten the key words of that little story, and I'll come back to another time, and we'll chop that off the tape, and I'll come back to it. Sorry about that.
That's all right. All right, we'll stop for today and then come back to the rest of the on another occasion.